Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Brew Theology Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Miller, and on today's episode, number 21, I'll be gathering with friends across the religious and theological spectrum with the topic, The Empire Strikes Back? Yes, there's a question mark there. We're kind of into a Star Wars theme lately, doing a little Rogue One from last episode of Hanukkah. This one is about God and Empire, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, Constantinople, Britain, and maybe a few more that you will be able to mention that and that we will talk about in this episode. I want to give you three quotes from three different theologians and ministry leaders. The first one is from Walter Brueggemann, an Old Testament theologian who says the following: "The massive power of empire creates an all-encompassing presence, leaving no segment of human society in the shadows. Governance, economic systems, arts, social structures, education, and entertainment brightly reflect the glowing light of the preeminence of empire." And Brian Zahn states the following: "Empires are rich and powerful nations which believe they have a right to rule other nations and a manifest destiny to shape the world according to their agenda." Lastly, from theologian, process theologian, John Cobb Jr., "Empire is imposition of the will of one people on others, expressing itself militarily and territorially when appropriate." So enjoy this episode 21, and if you like it, please give us a rating on iTunes. 5 stars would be beautiful. Also, give us a review. That would be great as well as we usher in the new year. And speaking of the new year, 2017, we want to do what we do in Denver across the nation. This episode, this gathering, this podcast is a microcosm of what happens in the Brew Theology community of Denver. So we have about 5 or 6 people every episode here within a 1-hour session. We do this every Thursday with multiple groups of about 8 to 10 people in 2-hour segments. I would love to provide anyone out there in any town, in any community or church with coaching and training. Janelle and myself, we have some experience in ministry, almost 2 decades now. And we believe that what we're doing here in Denver, both theologically, philosophically, and socially, communally, is making a difference in our world, in our communities, and we think it can do the same in yours. Again, go to brewtheology.org if you haven't been there yet, and check out the different levels of partnership and different incentives that you can get throughout that. You can also visit us on Patreon. We have a Patreon page, a Brew Theology Patreon page, where you can individually sponsor us to get this going. There are incentives. You can give $1 a month. You can give $5. $25. And there are different kickbacks for that, some cool swag along, and rewards for helping supporting the Brew Theology podcast and community, this alliance where we want to create healthy, meaningful, and eclectic dialogues in pub communities and coffee houses across this nation. So please help us, friends. Share on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And you can always find us there at Brew Theology. Our Twitter has a Brew_Theology in that username. And we will see you on the other side. Peace. Well, hello, friends. Welcome to another Brew Theology podcast. Yeah. Here with some pretty awesome friends tonight. We'll do some brief introductions and then get into a little Empire Strikes Back. I'm Ryan. You all know my story at this point. But since it is 2017, Happy New Year!
Hey!
And I will... Well, I already gave my label away, my new label. But I grew up... So I grew up Southern Baptist Evangelical, yada, yada, yada. You've heard that before. You know, I actually appreciate women in ministry, so I quit being Baptist. I have gleaned from the Anabaptist, the United Methodist. Got one over here to my right, and some Pentecostals and some Jewish people over the years. And over the last 4 years, I've dabbed in, well, before that, open theism led me to process theology, so I am a little processy these days. So I'm a evolving pro-Anabaptist Metho-Jew-Costal follower of Jesus. And I'm excited about this topic that Dan wrote about a year and a half ago, and it's still relevant today.
All right, I'm Andy. I grew up in an interfaith household, so my dad's family is all Jewish, my mom's family is all Christian.
I identify as a Christian, and I work for the United Methodist Church, but I still raise a ruckus from inside. I have a lot of liberationist influences on my theology, as well as process influences on my theology. So this conversation about empire and how empire relates to our faith and our current structures really interests me. So, yeah.
Hey, I'm Shoshana. I was raised in a Jewish household, went to Jewish school for 13 years, and am still Jewish, kind of trying to figure out where Judaism has a role in my life. A lot of my personal traditions are also Jewish, and so trying to figure out where I want to make time for religion as religion and also just celebrating tradition as I have growing up. I like to learn about religion. I like to learn from other people, and that's kind of how I have manifested interfaith dialogue into my life.
My name is Dan Rosado, and I was raised as a Pentecostal charismatic Christian. In college, I found an alternative theology in Calvinism, moved away from that, and found Eastern Orthodox Christianity, and took the aspects that I liked from it and rejected the things I didn't like. And now I still consider myself Christian, influenced by process philosophy and Eastern thought.
I'm Megan. I was brought up in an evangelical home, and when I was in like my tween years, I started learning more about religion, but kind of came to this conclusion that there probably wasn't a God. And then I converted to Mormonism, and it changed my life, and I was very active in it, and served a mission, and went to church school. But about a year ago, I left that, and now just trying to figure things out, and I'm really open to studying, but not as set on declaring something so quickly.
Great. Tonight should be a good discussion. So just to remind everybody of the guidelines, and if you're doing this in your own community as well, these are important. No soapboxes allowed. No one person or viewpoint gets the last word. Number two is respect all others and their viewpoints. Three, extend courtesy by listening well. And four, everything is up for discussion. So, the Empire Strikes Back. It would seem as if the history of empire is the history of human civilization, violence, and conquest. Scientists and scholars debate the start of humanity's involvement in war and violence. Some argue that our primitive hunter-gatherer ancestors lived mostly at peace, and it was the introduction of agriculture and land ownership that propelled human civilization into greater conflict. Others would argue that that's how it's always been. Civilization also influenced religion as well. Many ancient religions have had, at some point in their history, a god of war. Over time, the deity began to take the shape of a nation's king or governing body, or perhaps vice versa. With the rise of monolatrism, the recognition of the existence of many gods, but the worship of one deity, and monotheism, the belief in the existence of one god, the deity began to advocate for the interests of the empire.
In the Jewish tradition, the most well-known example of a polytheistic is that of Egypt. The will of Pharaoh was synonymous with the will of God. Since Pharaoh was generally believed to be the incarnation of the god Horus, so it follows that the imposition of the will of Pharaoh, however oppressive it might have been, was in fact the will of God. Unfortunately, history shows that the oppressed often become the oppressors, so the Israelites, still under foreign occupation, took after their oppressors in how they established their government, their armies, and wars of conquest for themselves. As John Cobb notes, when Israel was defeated and subjugated, many of the Hebrews understood that God had abandoned them, and they begged God to return to lead them again to victory over their enemies. The violent, dehumanizing conquest of an enemy was seen as the favor of God. By the time Jesus was born, the expectation of a Davidic Messiah was solidified. David's reign was seen with a sense of nostalgia. The people longed for a Messiah to unify the tribes of Israel and bring peace. In comes Jesus. As Jesus began to gather more and more followers, his disciples came to identify him as a Jewish Messiah. For Jesus' friends, this meant that there was hope for a world in which they could live free or saved from oppression. But the way of Jesus didn't meet the warrior king expectation. Instead of leading an insurrection, Jesus urges his followers to turn the other cheek and pray for those who persecuted them. By taking the titles often attributed to Caesar, Son of God, Lord, Savior, and using them to describe Jesus, Jesus and his disciples subverted Caesar's authority. While Jesus frames peace as achieved through radical forgiveness, Pax Romana was achieved by identifying others as enemies and fighting against them until they could no longer fight back. While Jesus measures justice by how we treat the poor, the orphan, and the widow, Roman justice, Lucia? I'm not going to pronounce that right anyways. Where we get the word justice, the Roman goddess who personified right rule, is shown blindfolded, like the Roman Fortuna, who represented fate, and with a sword, like the Greek Nemesis, who represented divine retribution.
As mentioned before, the oppressed often become the oppressors. After Jesus' death, many Christians were persecuted up until Constantine, the Great Edict of Milan, and First Council of Nicaea. 67 years after the Edict of Milan, Emperor Theodosius I made Nicene Christianity the state church of the Roman Empire with the Edict of Thessalonica, where early Christian gatherings were once known for being a radical alternative to the powers and principalities of the world. Christianity has now become the empire itself, and the rest is history.
Bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum. Okay.
That's enough of that.
So, how do you all see God's relationship, or how do you perceive God's relationship, or the divine consciousness, whatever you want to speak of God, to rich and powerful nations throughout history? And then we'll move to today later. That's the second part of the question, but how do you perceive that, the divine God, that relationship to rich and powerful nations throughout history?
And you could reference your own tradition and the stories that have been told.
Well, it seems like nations that have enough confidence and dominance always think they're the chosen ones. I'm thinking of China specifically, Middle Kingdom. They're the Middle Kingdom. They're China, in Chinese, literally is the Middle Kingdom, at Zhongguo. And so I think that it's just so, I don't know, it's so believable and predictable that nations that have dominance and are confident and recognize that, their authority, obviously think that they are, like, chosen, they have this divine right, they, of course they are where they are because they've been given this as some divine gift.
Well, I think also I'm just wondering, in some ways, can we throw chicken or the egg in here? You know, is this nation rich and powerful because God made them so? Or do rich and powerful nations happen to also believe in God? That's not really a great chicken or the egg question, but just in terms of, like, sure, what's that relationship in terms of what's influencing what?
I think it's nice to have a deity or a mascot or I hate to do sports metaphors, but I love sports. It's nice to have a team. It's nice to have a winning team. And when your team's winning, you know, you jump on the bandwagon. I mean, even if it's like, oh, I kind of follow this team, but once they're, you know, hey, they're actually winning, they're in first place, you get more of the support. And I think the same would be true about a god. So these gods have always existed in many kinds of forms and shapes and sizes. And it's like, oh, like, we're winning, so let's jump on that god.
And I think one population can, at different times, cycle through as both powerful and powerless. So I look at the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, and you see the story of, you know, God's people and the Israelites who are oppressed, and God comes and saves them, and then next thing you know, they become this imperial force, and so then another group comes in and takes over, and then they call out for God, and God comes and saves the oppressed and liberates them. And so the cycle of even communities themselves can go through periods of having, you know, power, being rich, having the status, not having it. And so I don't see God as picking a nation as much as a state of being. So instead of God saying, I'm going to be with this group of people who's constantly fluctuating, I'm going to be with people on the underside. I'm going to be people who are marginalized. I'm going to be people who are oppressed. So I see God as not with a certain country, not a certain group, but rather with this idea or this concept of those who are on the underside. So
which seems to be the opposite of this entire narrative and script.
Yes.
All right. Andy is not just the devil's advocate. He is the devil according to this narrative. What? Which might not be a bad thing.
So I'd be curious if everyone could talk to kind of how they grew up and the stories they heard. Back to, like, your chicken and egg thing. How did your tradition or your community speak of these stories and God's involvement or maybe God wasn't involved at all. How did they perceive that or talk about that, interpret it?
To be honest, in my personal experience of Jewish education and with the people in my life who I was also learning from, but not necessarily in a strictly school-based educational way, Jews are taught, again, my high experience being taught, that we're the chosen people, straight up. Like, it's extremely explicit. Jews are the chosen people. That's the bottom line. There's just no discussion. It's not that there's no discussion because we can't ask about it because Jews love to ask and discuss, but it's just like, yeah, of course, clap, yes. And so within that persecution, it's when Jews are kind of being the ones who are oppressed, it's like, no worries. If God chose us as the chosen people, he always has our back. So yes, we're going to suffer, and yes, we're going to experience this, for lack of a better term, like, really, like, the word is escaping, but just, like, negative persecution. I'm just going to use the word again. But no worries. There's nothing that we can't handle because God's not going to wipe out his favorite group.
So did God's having the back of the chosen people, what did that look like? Or, you know, what was that narrative?
I honestly don't know. I don't know what that looked like in a lot of these stories.
But even, like,
or even
in a modern context.
Yeah. Well, right, so modern for me is, like, in terms of persecution, would be the Holocaust, but I've never really spoken to somebody in the Holocaust and asked, like, well, because we're the chosen people, was there some part of you that held onto that idea and felt reassured by the fact that, if not you specifically, but that this religion was still going to prevail? Because when I was at the age where I was really engaging with a lot of those people, like my friends, grandparents, or family friends, I wasn't cognitively thinking about those questions.
Yeah.
So I don't want to put you on the spot, but how does this kind of theological understanding of God kind of being with chosen people relate to kind of the politics of 2016 or the lived experience of 2016? Is there a correlation? Are they the same? Does it make sense?
Will you ask it again?
I'm just thinking about how this applies to, say, the modern Israeli state. How does this apply to its expression outside of religion into kind of the sociopolitical? Because obviously, you know, Christianity, Judaism, all these belief systems exist as a theological construct, but also as a sociopolitical construct.
And if you don't feel comfortable,
you don't have to answer. I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No,
there.
No,
that's
no,
why
I don't
I
do the whole discomfort feeling thing. obviously, like, feel uncomfortable about things, but my threshold for discomfort is, like, really on the ground. Kind of core, earth core kind of vibe. I think it really depends on who you ask. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to, like, speak on behalf of all Israelis or, like, all American Jews or Jewish Americans. But, yeah, that idea is definitely ingrained in Israeli culture and Israeli politics. So I'm just going to bring up a concept of how the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, works. So in very, very, there's this, and honestly, this was very prevalent when I last lived in Israel, which was in, I want to say, like, 2012, 2013. Mm-hmm. And very, very religious Jews are basically exempt from entering the army because instead they are studying Torah. Mm-hmm. And so they, as the chosen people, are doing their due diligence of studying for the rest of the Jewish people. And so in some ways they're still carrying out their citizenship duties. I don't know how to say that in the best way.
Yeah.
But that's, of course, a huge discussion because if as an Israeli Jew or an Israeli who's not Jewish, especially, if you don't believe in God or believe in the way that like part of Judaism that believes that studying is gonna like lead us to a good place or is like an integral part of being Jewish, then it's like, okay, so I can send my 18-year-old child to war, but like you can just sit at home and read Torah.
Right.
Like that's not gonna work. And so, and I wonder if part of that comes from like, well, we're the chosen people, so we need to keep praying, but like all we have to do is keep praying.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't need to be on those front lines. It's like, well, when you're being attacked all the time, you kind of do, because if you're not, if we're all just sitting in our home studying, then that's not really how
right
armies work. You know, it's
right.
Just not going to
yeah.
put, I
think you had this same story going on even within Christianity, mm-hmm. where you have the church, the people of the, you know, the cloth or the collar, whatever. You don't have to have a cloth or a collar, but it's like we're pastors and we study, we pray, we take care of our flock, but yet there's a, but we have our military out there taking care of our freedoms in our country for the sake of God and country, and it is this weird, it's almost like a dualistic thing, like, I mean, so I don't think it's separate, and I wonder if this is across the board of all religions and all tribes, where you have your priestly people doing priestly things, godly things, and then you have your people who are doing like, no, we're going to take action, we're going to kick ass, we're going to go out there on the front lines. But it's like an understood agreement between the two.
And I think community needs both of those people because communities have roles. We all have roles in our communities as different, you know, we need somebody who's going to be on the front lines, we need somebody who's going to be taking care of the people who are wounded. Like, we need so many different people for things. I think that the tension comes from the fact that it's not a, I'm so grateful that you're staying home and you're studying because that's providing us with this need, that's meeting this need that we have. It's, why do you feel entitled to sit home when we are all making the sacrifice? And I think that there are ways when we can look at it like it's filling needs, but I don't think that, so, in terms of politics, it's being seen that way.
Do you think, and do we all think this, that the religious people who, we say sitting at home, they're doing something religious.
Yeah.
You know, do we think that they need the other, that they need the frontline soldiers, and the soldiers need them? That's my empire question. Does one we need the other?
To what goal?
To the goal of the city on a hill, Dan.
Okay.
The goal of the manifest destiny.
Because
the goal
that's exactly what happened in Nazi Germany. To be honest.
Right.
You had the priestly, quote, Christians, and then you had the military, and they had a goal, but it was arguably different than what largely most religions in the world have to say about.
I'm thinking Hanukkah right now because we just did that podcast, but I mean, thinking if they just sat there and didn't put the dreidels out and they just sat there and they studied the whole time and people came in and they tried to massacre them and they just sat stagnant, that's not going to work out well for us. You know what I mean? We need people who are going to continue to question and further that religion and further our understanding of that and our participation in that religion. But at the same time, if we're just sitting stagnant, then, and because we're so focused into that, to that learning, we're not going to continue learning
we like to attribute this whole idea of empire and military might, and even those who are not fighting, but yet who support the fighting, and we create this God narrative out of it. And going back to about, you know, 10 minutes ago with Andy being the devil / devil's advocate, you know, I wonder if, because you were saying that they're, God's on the side of those who are the oppressed. So does the oppressed need a fighter, a literal fighter?
That's a really hard question to answer. I would say no, personally. I don't know if you're directing that question at me.
It's to everybody.
Okay.
It's to everybody.
You called me out, so that's why I thought I should probably respond.
I did call you up because you're the one that initially had brought this up.
Yeah. So I would look at a radical restructuring of societal norms and of the systems that we participate in. I think we only need a army if our way of doing relationship with other communities is by fighting them. I have to believe that there's a possibility where that's not the only way. And I see a different way laid out throughout the Christian scriptures and the Hebrew texts. And so, yeah, I don't think that you need to have that military might, that armed force, in order to support kind of this subaltern or this marginalized movement. That being said, almost every movement of kind of socialist uprising, leftist peoples coming up against oppressive regimes has involved military might and force and fighting. So maybe I'm saying that out of a position of privilege as, you know, white guy living in Denver, but
a white guy living in Denver.
Yeah. I think to challenge your question, though, you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know what words you got, but it sounds like you were saying that God's on the side of the oppressed. Did I think about that?
That was what I was saying.
Andy made that statement earlier, yeah.
Okay.
So I think
that's the perspective. God's on the side of the oppressed and the oppressor. Just depends on who's talking and when we're talking. So, Nazi Germany. Well, a lot of Jews survived, or a lot of people survived, a lot of people were persecuted, and a lot of people died. And at some point, depending on what year you're talking about, some people are might say, you know, let's say somebody speaking from a Nazi perspective, you know, we were right to do this. God's on our side. Can't you see how God's on, if they're religious, can't you see how God's on our side? This facilitation of persecution is happening just the way that we planned. And then if you're asking a few years later, from somebody who is persecuted perspective, thank goodness God was on our side because we have come out alive, or if not, somebody's still surviving, somebody's still going, and that back and forth is always going to happen. There's never going to be that the oppressed is always, to say it like really casually because it's what first came to mind, like always kicking it and just like hanging and they're grooving by, but the oppressors are on, they're not always going to win. That's just not how the game works. So, I mean, in some ways they are winning for a long time if we think of like really like specific examples of oppression in America and whatever. We can get in a lot of things. But in terms of how long is this going to last for? And we talked, yeah, I can go into it.
Yeah, so I mean, America is pretty like a small fraction of a story compared to Egypt. Egypt was a pretty long, extensive, I mean, these pharaohs in charge for quite a while. And that's the story of even liberation theology. It's rooted in this Exodus narrative of slaves crying out in Egypt.
But how many years? Religion, we're like, we're talking, we do the thousands thing, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So somebody's going to have to, it's going to have to switch at some point. I guess it doesn't have to, it seems like it has been.
I'm curious, how did, you know, your various upbringings interpret some of this, some of the stories of the tradition, or some of the stories of today, you know, whatever that was?
A lot of it was, we are, it's almost like that escaping persecution from Europe, coming to America. I mean, that's the history of the States, because in the name of Jesus, we are free. So now we're the city on a hill to spread this faith, to become the greatest nation, to then influence other nations. That's the narrative. My parents didn't tell me that narrative, but that's the narrative that was ingrained somewhere. That's what I believed most of my life. I don't now. Yeah, but that's what it was.
So I just want to make sure I have all these different interpretations of what that question is, like basically what your tradition is and why you're chosen, if there is that mindset.
Well, just whatever, like when you were a Mormon, there's certain texts that tell this narrative of how Scripture was received and how the community lived out its life. And in almost every story, there's a story of struggle.
Yeah.
And what was God's role in that was, you know...
Mormonism has a lot of struggle. So having been very very dedicated Mormon, I really got into reading the church's history, which ultimately brought me out of it. But that was something that was it's very emotional to study Mormon history, especially when you talk about Mormonism from the start paints this narrative of being persecuted from the very beginning. Essentially it was. Now the reasons for its persecution are very debatable, especially in the Mormon community, but I mean, from the very beginning, the prophet in the LDS church, Mormon church, Joseph Smith, was persecuted, and even as a young man, you know, for having seen the angel Moroni, or having seen this vision of God and Jesus Christ, and then the angel Moroni. And so you get this narrative of constantly pushing through. And what it brings me to think of is the pioneers, when they essentially left Nauvoo, Illinois, the Mormon pioneers, after Joseph Smith was killed or martyred. Brigham Young was around then, and the story of the pioneers moving westward and eventually settling in the Salt Lake Valley is a story of struggle, and it's sad. So many people died, but it was this ideology and this faith and this perseverance of pushing through. And there's some Mormon hymns that are very very well known in the LDS church and constantly sung. One is Come, Come, Ye Saints, and there's a part in there that says, fresh courage take, and that always stuck out in my mind. It's like, no matter what you go through, like the Mormon narrative is constant struggle. And even today, it's like you take that, yeah, fresh courage take. Like you, every battle you go through, you start again. And so now there's like this, the Mormon community, I think a lot of people feel this tension as well due to some church policies that are new and somewhat disagreeable, especially with politically. And so the Mormon narrative is very like, you keep pushing through, you're always gonna be persecuted, but that's almost kind of a sign that you're doing things right, because the world will always tell you you're wrong. And I remember a leader in where I was from, there's always protesters at Mormon events against Mormonism, and he said, when they stop protesting, that's when we know that we're doing something wrong. And so it's kind of like this idea of the world will be against you, and that's kind of like how you can check yourself and know, okay, yeah, I'm doing it right if the world's against me.
That seems to be probably most people's experience.
It's kind of ubiquitous.
Because if I'm right, and you think I'm wrong, and oh wait, you all think I'm wrong. I mean, you need to stand. Most people don't say, maybe I should do a little bit of a looking in the mirror, a self-critique here of my religion and what my parents taught me.
Yeah,
it's like, no, you're persecuted, you know, and God's on your side, so rise up, young man, young woman of faith.
And essentially, I mean, it goes along with most Christian traditions. I mean, I grew up, I have some family that is evangelical, and it's also the same narrative. But I feel like even some of that ties in very politically when you're talking about kind of like the evangelical view. You know, it's because that, a lot of that comes down to even voting, how your voting is a reflection of your faith. And that's kind of like where you find this challenge, but almost another balance to kind of check yourself again, like, okay, am I doing something right? Oh, if they're all against me, then we must be doing something right.
How about, I mean, number three is tied into a lot of this. Is an imperial or dominating mindset inherent to religious faith? What do you think? And is that mindset, you know, is that resonant with or in conflict with your non-religious and religious views specifically? It's a big question. All right. How do you view, here it is, the 2003 invasion of Iraq or the displacement of Native American peoples?
I mean, we've already talked about this. We say God's on our side, and that gives us justification to do whatever atrocities we want. Sorry if that's a little harsh there. But yeah, I mean, I don't think that religion is inherently dominating or coercive or corruptive or any of these things. I think that people are going to use whatever systems are around them to justify their actions. And religion has more or less always been there in some form for communities. So it makes a really easy scapegoat to say, well, God's on my side, so that's why we're going to, you know, screw over this group of people. And I mean, that's been happening by almost every major religious group that you can think of throughout recorded history.
Yeah, there's an entitlement piece of religiosity where it's like, well, this is ours and we're allowed to and we should be doing it. Mm-hmm. And I think not only is there not going to be a consequence, but we might be rewarded for that. Mm-hmm. And so let's keep going.
So I can't help but think of the pluralistic question, right? Because if everyone thinks that their God thinks that they're chosen, like if you don't buy into that anymore and you're in our current context where we're in a room with, you know, people of different faiths and different traditions, like how do our stories change, and what kinds of things do we have to do to transcend, for lack of better words, those aspects of our religions that are dominating or othering, if you will,
while still keeping your
I think we have to get rid of the warrior God. And that's the warrior God has been around for so long. You can't just say, oh, let's get over it. I mean, this is something that's going to take, I think it's starting to happen within Western, I hate to say this, it's in the academic circles, because it seems like it's an elite thing, because only, you know, the elite are in the academic circles, or people who are privileged, or this or that. But, I mean, in a way, those people, it's easy for them to say, because they're not oppressed. So then it goes back to the question of, well, the oppressed typically aren't educated, and anyway, it's almost nihilistic. Does it seem that way?
I think part of it has to do with the weight that we put on different components of religion.
So my religion can look really differently, and it can look really differently in really different things, and I can use it as an excuse, or I can use it to inspire me to do something that's good instead of depending on it to use as a scapegoat of holding the, like, of justification. So just because Jews might think they're the chosen people, well, what does that look like? What have we chosen to do? And I can answer that question, so that's not a good question to ask, but like, okay, so then what are we doing about it? And we can be using that in a way that's oppressive, or we can be using that in a way that's empowering, mm-hmm. or we can be using that in a way that's just something that influences our day-to-day. But I think it only becomes an issue, in my personal perspective, when we use it to feel justified, or we're letting our religion and a part of our religion that we thought worked for us in that moment take accountability for our behavior rather than take accountability ourselves, because that feels easier. And I think that's when it becomes a problem. And I think sometimes we use it to take accountability for us being good, which we talked about last time and we won't get into now, but yeah.
I think that's a major part, at least as a Christian, it has been in my personal walk of faith, has been reading about and owning up to all aspects of the Christian tradition, the good and the bad. And I think there's, at least in the American context, there aren't many people that are aware or choose to be aware of all the horrible things that we've done or haven't done, which is a beautiful confession, by the way, for the churches that do confession. And the things that we're doing now and the things that we'll do in the future as Christians. Because it's very easy to dismiss certain historical facts by saying, oh, they weren't actual Christians because they acted that way. Well, okay. At what point are you going to actually take ownership of that? No, we actually did that. And we thought that God told us, or we thought that we were justified. And it's hard.
It is really hard because, like, so, I mean, I can think of people who claim to be Christian who I would have a hard time finding a connection between their beliefs and Christ. I think of the first thing off the top of my head was Westboro Baptist Church. They claim to be a church. They claim to say that we are, you know, Christians living Christ's vision for what community looks like in the world. I have a very hard time seeing that or rationalizing that as any kind of Christianity that I can recognize. So I think there's got to be a line somewhere where here are tenets of what it means to be part of this group, and there's got to be an in-out somewhere. Now where that is, I don't know, but...
Remember when Westboro Baptist Church was the worst instantiation of Christianity? Those were good times, huh?
No, I miss that.
So, I mean, I don't mean to be overly reductive, but it boils down to, like, how can you really tell when your actions are in the spirit of your religion? You know, you talk about Corinthians and the fruits of the Spirit, which I have, you know, I've been studying, or because I feel like every religion calls its practitioners to do something harder than their habitual stance. I mean, you know, you look at, and I'm not a Torah scholar, but, you know, you look at the Torah and there's a lot of practices of faith that are rigorous and hard to adhere to on a regular basis, and that's a way of showing your faith. I mean, in Buddhism, you know, it's taking the harder path, walking the middle road between, you know, repression and acting out, and asking yourself always, what is the right thing? Taoism, what is the right thing? Christianity, put yourself up on the cross. Like, I mean, take the hard path. You know what I mean? And so in some ways, like, I feel like the story of, like, the, you know, the struggle of, like, it's hard to separate the, what Megan was talking about, like, you know we're right because the world is telling us wrong. In some ways, it's like, yeah, like, habitual hedonistic stuff that we all do, like, isn't typically considered particularly spiritual or growing or enriching experiences. And yet, I think that's really easy to misconstrue as not, I don't know, somehow, like, you also have to be also questioning yourself all the time. You know, am I really doing the right thing by my faith?
Are you asking this question, because that last part switched it, but I was wondering throughout the whole thing, like, are you asking, are those personal individuals asking those questions, or are people from the outside asking if that community or if those groups of people are asking?
I feel like people have to ask themselves, or groups have to ask themselves, like, And everyone's going
to
walk.
Because we have to be honest with ourselves. And
to be really honest.
And I think that can be really tough if we're not willing to do that internal psychoanalysis.
I think that's right. And I think that especially if you do buy into the notion that inherently we are kind of brutish, you know, and we are kind of hedonistic and we are, you know, kind of selfish, you know, if you buy into that as being parts of our nature, then it's like we always have to be looking and asking, is this really right? Is this going to lead to something better for more people? But that, oh my gosh, so that's reductive again. Like, what is the nature of humanity? Like, are we inherently good? Are we inherently hedonistic? Like, you know, what is it?
Easy question.
Easy questions. We're going to get to the bottom of it in the next 5 minutes, I think.
Well, constantly asking yourself that question can, like, well, you know, many things can be taken and, almost abused and used can have a negative effect. But I think constantly asking a question, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the right thing all the time? Makes you question what is the right thing. You can reflect on whatever spiritual or text you may or may not have, you know, whatever is your inspiration. And yeah, there's like pretty much faults in all of them. I mean, I haven't studied all of them, so I can't say they all do. But from what I have studied, you know, there's, well, you know, God told me to kill this guy so I can get the gold plates for the history of our family. So it's all right. I'm gonna kill Laban. You know, that's a Book of Mormon story, and it like messes with people's heads. And it's like, okay, well, where do you draw the line? And I think that can become an obsession and become very unhealthy for people. It's like, well, how do I measure up constantly to meet this this proverbial level of righteousness?
That's fair.
And I mean, it kind of comes down to like, I don't want to bring it into this rabbit hole, but I'm just gonna leave it like it could come down to an epistemological problem, like epistemological search. It could come down to an objective truth search. That, I mean, where does that end? You know, constantly asking yourself this question, so it'll make you question your faith. You know.
But yet, if we don't always ask, it's easy to go astray. I don't know.
Yeah, it's true.
Right?
It's true.
I don't know. Yeah.
So as a Christian and Christ follower, somebody who says, okay, I want to follow Jesus, and I can then objectively look back at history, and I can see this first century Jew who subverts this norm of society and, you know, throws tables and says, okay, but I'm not going to be the zealot you want me to be, and I'm going to be put on this cross and say, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Like you said, Liz, this guy who's like, he's on a cross. Oh, I mean,
dying in the sun.
This is the part that gets me. And then you look at history and you see Constantine comes on board. He says, okay, we're going to make a religion out of this. This makes sense politically. And if you look at history, it did make sense. And then we have this success, this empire, this reign that's continued even today in our country. So what is it going to take for Western Christians? And I'm going to, sorry to get preachy here, but what's it going to take for Western Christians, those who can look at history and see the rabbi that you choose to follow and profess, who's on a cross, and say, we have put people on crosses for thousands of years. And it's time we say, maybe we should look at this devil's advocate, Andy, to my right over here, and say, maybe he was right from the beginning with the first 5-10 minutes of this podcast, and say, what does it look like for us to live in solidarity with those who are oppressed? That's the life of Christ, versus saying, I'm on top, and I'm going to stay on top in the name of some mascot Jesus that doesn't even exist. Doesn't even exist. We've made that Jesus up. And yet there's a huge portion of our society that says, that's our king. This is our kingdom. And it's going to reign. And so I'm just curious. Like, I know I'm getting fired up. This is the ABV in the beer. But what's it going to take for people to say, self-critique and look back? See who the person that you're following, what is he about, what are his teachings? Read the freaking Gospels. That's all you got to do. And then look at history. And now where are we today? Will this, addiction to empire cease? Will it cease?
I think it's hard. I think it takes a lot of dedication to be uncomfortable with discomfort, to identify with the loser. I mean, it's not a serotonin rush whatsoever.
No.
To do it. And it's painful. And how do we walk around, you know, with a burden of pain and not let it destroy us, you know? And how do we walk around understanding the pain of other people without it destroying us? I mean, I don't think that's I think there again, it's like, let's turn away from human nature, which is to feel good all the time, and ask ourselves, like, what would it take to have a practice where we were not choosing that route? I mean, that's an intentional spiritual practice. You have to renew it every day. Like,
I think it partially entails sharing the suffering in community. I think maybe in our American top context, that's one of the aspects that's difficult. At least in the type of evangelical, charismatic, conservative, you know, all the adjectives, upbringing, it didn't define Christianity or being a Christian as a Christ follower. I mean, I think that's something that Christians need to work out. For some, it was you say this prayer and then you go to church every Sunday and that's pretty much it. Because you got your ticket to heaven. Maybe tithe the church and, you know, stay low-key, but...
So does discipleship, meaning to follow
yes.
one's rabbi, whatever tradition you're in, whether you're following the Buddha or the Jesus or any
Jesus.
Rabbi under the sun...
I believe it's the Christ.
The Jesus.
Historically.
The Jesus.
Sorry.
But will, is that the answer, then? If you actually follow the teachings of this religious figure...
More than that, I think the community piece is
yes.
also meeting people who follow other religious figures, who follow have other systems that they're putting their, you know, the weight of their life in. I mean, it's...
Liz, your question, how do you understand the experience of those who, you know, are power and are oppressing and our roles and those are impacting? How do we understand their lives? We understand it by meeting them, by listening to their stories about their lived experience, about their lives. And I think until we can acknowledge the fact that our decisions have an impact on the lives of other people, which as Americans we're really hesitant to do, I don't know how you get to that point until you finally do that, until you finally say, yes, my decisions have an impact on Ryan's life and Megan's life and Dan's life and everybody's life in the room. But you can't understand their experience if you don't actually realize that, hey, my life impacts their experience.
And the beauty of that is that you also humanize... those that might have been demonized before, right? And I think that's part of the problem with, like, that's how empires stay alive, is we dehumanize and demonize some other group, and that's what keeps the whole thing alive. And that's why people are terrified, and I'm going to bring it there, to, you know, associate yourselves with refugees or... you know, other groups that are seen as these outsiders, they're sketchy, blah, blah, blah. And I think there is a way of doing that and still being faithful to our traditions. Because
mm-hmm.
I know at least from my upbringing, I can think immediately that the, you know, a conservative evangelical response might be, well, my faith might be tainted by associating with someone who's Jewish or Buddhist or Muslim, especially Muslim in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that necessarily has to be true.
For me, it just sounds like you're not... Sorry to be... I'm just going to go for it. Like, you're not strong enough in your faith to be able to hear other perspectives or ask more questions.
If it's that feeble that you can't even
hear
something.
Yeah, it's like you
can't
even...
my faith is
gone. Exactly, yeah. One thing that I always loved about Judaism and really felt this in Jewish education was that we were always, at least in my school, we were always encouraged to ask questions. We were always encouraged to challenge. And I think that's a huge part of Judaism, like to have the Talmud and the Gemara. It's like commentary on the commentary on the commentary. It's like, let's keep asking, let's keep pushing the boundaries, let's keep grappling with it, because it's okay to do that. And it's not, just because you're doing that doesn't mean that you're any less religious or you're any less faith oriented, but it's that you want to continue to grow
right.
and grow with others in your religion and in your faith, and that's really healthy and really important. And so in a really judgmental way, I've always felt like to not be able to engage in dialogue or ask questions, or to, when people ask questions, to be shut down. It's like, yikes, you should what's going on that you are so afraid to answer those questions or have those conversations? You should be able to do that and feel really proud and empowered by that, rather than feel like, oh, we can't go there. Don't ask that.
Yeah. What Shoshana, for those who are listening right now, still, by the way, you're talking about this, the Talmud and the Gemara, which is rooted in this Jewish tradition, what they call the Mishnah, this oral tradition where you have a bunch of rabbis who get together and they disagree and you have ongoing conversations back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, but every single voice in that conversation matters, even though they might land on, you know, the answer is A or B or C, but still you don't ever discount the voices in the conversation. Yeah. And I think that's also, if you have, going back to the Talmud, this way we've been, this is good. We've been had like 3 episodes on Judaism now, or 4. If you get back to the discussion and the debate, and you actually you leave, okay, like I'm not gonna kill you. I'm still gonna love you and respect you and value you as a person. Maybe that's the death of empire, huh?
Okay.
I don't know.
So off of that, so Jürg Rieger, he's a German theologian. He comes out of the Wesleyan tradition. But he talks about how empire doesn't just want to kind of take over your material resources, your, you know, the systems that you have, your things that you own. But empire goes after what you think and says that the only way to think is the way of empire, is to say the only way I can have power is by taking over these people. And so even having these conversations, the idea of empire as a construct, I mean, is trying to prevent those conversations from happening, prevent you from being able to take that step back and actually look at why am I thinking the way that I think. And that's what makes empire so hard to fight against, is because it doesn't just go after the economics, doesn't just go after the social systems, it goes after everything.
So I'm curious, at minute 53, do you think that people who actually ascribe to empire have already tuned us out? Because of what you just said.
Probably.
My follow-up question, somewhat related, was what hope is there? Like, coming from our different backgrounds and traditions, what hope is there? How are we to be in this great American empire?
Crickets.
Well, I think part of what you're saying, Andy, and to relate to your question, Dan, is that taking back the power. When people, especially right now what's going on, like, there is a voice that's getting louder and louder. And I think people like to pretend like it wasn't there, and it was, and we just weren't listening. And they're trying to encourage us. I think they, I don't like using those words, but I think there's a voice that's trying to encourage other people to ascribe to that. And that's part of the empire that it's, and that's growing. And it's to say, not on my watch, not for me. And to say, you can want me to think the way that you're thinking, and you can try to normalize your perspective, and that's not normal, and that's not my normal, and I'm going to be loud about it, and I'm going to talk about it, and I'm going to talk about it with other people, and I'm going to be listening to other people, and even if you don't think those voices are important, I do, and I'm going to make them louder so you don't turn them out. We have to prioritize that instead of allowing those social and theological and material gesticulating and like hoping that's going to bring me closer to them when it's not. Getting us to a certain place, and it's like, okay, so then let's just make sure that if that's the place that they want to go and we don't want to go there, then let's make sure that we're doing something to not bring us there.
But asking questions and believing in lived experience and believing people's actual experiences and not and treating humans like humans instead of humans like concepts, I think that gets us a long ways.
My personal view is that the Christian response to our current context is the same no matter who's in power. I mean, it is specifically and it's contextually situated, but it is to form alternative communities. That which empire says is not possible, you make it possible. And in our specific 21st century context, kind of forget what century we're in, 21st century context, it has to include people of other faiths, at least for me personally.
Or like, voices.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, I think, what you're saying.
Yeah, that's
a
what
specific
I meant.
Way.
And having this unity without uniformity, like putting a value on differences and just working off of what the best that we have together, whether that's has a religious slant to it or not, it doesn't matter to me.
I really don't know.
I don't want to have a last word.
Because everything I think of, I can just see a way that it can all be bastardized. So I don't know. Like, recognizing that, not ignoring problems. And by that, I mean taking an issue to try to understand something that maybe is uncomfortable to recognize. Mm-hmm. That, because I think just, like, constantly taking action, there's too many people that take action and don't know what they're doing, and they end up ruining a lot of things. I think just, like, trying to become comfortable with the process of understanding and trying to learn about uncomfortable things that might not go with your own personal narrative, but to be healthy about it. Like, being open to being in uncomfortable situations, of recognizing, like, yeah, maybe, you know what, maybe my family is very chauvinistic and I never realized it before. Or maybe, you know, just, like, things like that. And you're like, well, you know what, that probably is real. You know, so...
That's the only way you grow, right?
Yeah.
So go to the edge and then keep going.
Yeah.
Edge of your comfort.
Don't go there too fast.
But don't go too fast. I mean,
yeah. Baby steps to the other.
Ethically, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's 2017. We have a new year ahead of us. And we say this, and is as hard as it's going to be for a lot of people on the edge or under the hand of you know, the empire, so to speak. For us to be people who listen, I think is critical, and not to have the last word, but maybe we have the last question where we ask good questions in 2017. So let's do that. We encourage you all, if you're listening still, to ask good questions. So thank you all for having this conversation tonight.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.